From WNYC, New York Public Radio, this is the Leonard Lopate Show. I'm Leonard Lopate, and this is just one segment of our show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open from American Express, presenting the interactive webcast event, Making a Name for Yourself. Kate and Andy Spade and Bobby Brown discuss their leap from business to brand, created by Open from American Express. Registration at openforumonline.com.
In 1824, the Scottish poet James Hogg wrote The Private Memoirs and Confessions of a Justified Sinner. No one thought of the novel as a masterpiece at the time, and for decades critics dismissed Hogg as a minor writer. But now he's come to be recognized as a literary genius, the author of one of the world's first psychological novels. It is my great pleasure to welcome Dr. Gillian Hughes of the James Hogg Society to today's edition of our Summer Underappreciated Reading Series. Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you.
How did Hogg come to be known as the Ettrick Shepherd? Was he actually a shepherd?
He was. He was born into a very traditional peasant family in the Scottish borders. His father was a failed tenant farmer and shepherd. His mother belonged to a famous family in the locality called the Laidlaws, who were great tradition bearers. When Sir Walter Scott came into the Scottish borders in 1802 looking for traditional ballads, Hogg's mother was one of the people he visited, and she sang some of the great border ballads to him, particularly one called Old Maitland. And so Hogg, although he wasn't educated in the sense of having had a formal schooling, was brought up with these great traditions of the supernatural of the border ballads.
Was it unusual for writers of the time to gain such prominence without formal education and without having been born into a higher class?
It wasn't unheard of. Burns, of course, was the great exemplar of this, the ploughman poet. But in fact, his formal education was quite advanced compared with Hogg's. Hogg had perhaps had 6 months schooling in the whole of his life. He began at the parish school, and then his father went bankrupt. The family's effects were all sold off to appease their creditors, and Hogg, at the age of 6 or 7, was sent as a herd boy on one of the local farms to herd the cows, and he was paid a pair of new shoes was his wages for the season.
But this was at... Go ahead.
That was the end of his formal schooling.
But this was at the tail end of the Scottish Enlightenment, so there must have been a lot of, at least some kind of intellectual ferment at the time. Was how privy would he have been to it?
To begin with, perhaps not much, but he had a more of an oral upbringing. When he was a little herd boy, the other sort of category of farm worker who looked after these cows and a few odd lambs and things were old men whose strength was failing them. So the boy and the old man would spend time together, and these old men would tell Hogg tales. It wasn't until he was in his mid to late teens that he got any formal education. He re-taught himself to read and write by following texts that he knew very well, like the Shorter Catechism, the Scottish version of the metrical psalms. And as a teenager, he went to work at Blackhouse Farm, where he had a master who would encourage him, would lend him books. He was friendly with the eldest son, William Laidlaw, who became Sir Walter Scott's steward later at Abbotsford. So it wasn't until he was in his late teens that he hit a formal print culture and began to read books. And even then, to begin with, they would be books in the farmer's library, in local stores, in places like Peebles, and they'd be a bit old-fashioned. So in the 1790s, he was reading the classics of the mid-18th century. It wasn't until he became known to people like Scott that he actually read up-to-date books, which were very, very expensive in those days.
But he was writing poetry. Did that grow out of his mother's interest in Scottish ballads?
I think so. And he also had this experience as a late teenager where He talks about a half-daft man called Jock Scott who came to him on the hillside when he was looking after his sheep and recited Burns's poem Tam O'Shanter to him, which is a wonderful mix of traditional balladry and witchcraft lore and the ideas of the discourse of the Scottish Enlightenment, and that fusion of what he'd grown up with and the impact of the Edinburgh Enlightenment just came together in that poem for him. And he said he wouldn't let Jock Scott go until he'd repeated the poem and Hogg knew it by heart. And a lot of his early poetry was in imitation of Burns, who was the idol of his life.
But then later he wrote The Queen's Wake, perhaps his most notable poem, a book-length work about the return of Mary, Queen of Scots, from France. So this is very ambitious.
It's very ambitious. Hogg, I think, had a natural tendency to write shorter pieces. And he wrote a number of shorter pieces in 1812 in Edinburgh. And then he thought, how can I make these cohere? And he had this idea of a contest of minstrels at the court of Mary, Queen of Scots. And he put a lot of his own friends and his fellow poets in as the bards in the late medieval court, and they each sing or perform these ballads. And so there's a double interest in the poem of the ballads themselves and then the contest at the court. It's very much the Enlightenment, I think, was rather dismissive about Scotland's medieval and traditional past. They saw it as something barbaric that the country had outgrown. And Hogg and Scott and a number of the romantic generation saw the value in that past, that traditional culture, and brought it into the print culture. And Hogg is very much part of that movement.
We're talking about James Hogg as part of our Summer Underappreciated Reading Series with Gillian Hughes of the James Hogg Society. Hogg wrote a novel called The Private Memoirs and Confessions of a Justified Sinner that has been considered something of a literary masterpiece since the mid-40s, at least in this. I guess that's when it really was revived because of André Gide taking it up. But how did he wind up writing novels in the first place? Because that's rather ambitious for someone with his background. And how did he come to write this book?
He began by writing shorter stories in his own periodical called The Spy when he came to Edinburgh in 1810. He'd read Addison's Spectator, and he tried to do the equivalent in Edinburgh, but because he was a literary outsider, a peasant, somebody people looked down on, he regarded himself as a spy in the culture of the day. So he began to write short stories, and then he moved on to write longer fictions. As Scott and Byron's poetry, long poetry, became very successful, Scott changed then. Byron outdid Scott. Scott changed to writing novels, and the market for volumes of poetry went flat. There was no longer a great deal of money to be made from narrative poetry, with the exception perhaps of Byron. So Scott turned to novels, and Hogg thought he would turn to novels too. So he began with a traditional story called The Brownie of Bod's Beck, which is a story about persecution of the Covenanters in the Scottish borders, a theme which also comes into Confessions of a Justified Sinner. He wrote a historical novel about the taking of a castle with some wonderful witchcraft scenes called The Three Perils of Man, which I always think would make a marvellous film with somebody like Sean Connery as the Wizard of Akewood. And then he tried to write he wrote an earlier double narrative called The Three Perils of Woman, which has a double time scheme, just like the Confessions of a Justified Sinner. There's a modern 1820s narrative about a lowland girl who marries a Highlander and gives birth to the future nation, combining both traditions. And then the novel steps back a generation to Culloden, to the Jacobite period, and discusses a topic that Edinburgh wanted to forget about, which was the atrocities in the Highlands and the destruction of the Highland culture after 1745. So those previous writing experiences all went into the Private Memoirs and Confessions of a Justified Sinner, with its covenanters, its split narrative, its anxiety not to gloss over the discomforts of the past.
Can we call it his masterpiece?
I think we can, but I think it's perhaps not fair to think of him as a one-book writer, which is what can often happen. These days, with its popularity, there are so many paperback editions of Confessions, which is a wonderful book, but Hogg also wrote other wonderful books which are worth reading.
But perhaps it's because it's something that we can recognize today. The book's narrator is Robert Ringham, the justified sinner, and he believes he's one of the saved and therefore can do no wrong. And today we read this as a kind of a critique of religious fanaticism and self-righteousness. Was it intended to be that at the time?
Yes, I think it was intended to be that at the time. Hogg had been brought up in a very strictly Calvinist culture, which he loved and admired, but which was also restrictive to him sometimes as a writer. His own parents, for example, discouraged him from spending a lot of time on his reading because they felt that it wasn't going to help him as a shepherd, and that acceptable reading was largely religious reading.
Private Memoirs was written 20 years before Dostoevsky's The Double, 50 years before Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Is it one of the first psychological novels?
I think it's an interesting early version. There are other psychological novels. Hogg was particularly influenced by early German literature. He'd read works by a Swiss psychologist in translation called Zimmermann, who looked at the breakdown of a personality under conditions of social isolation. Hogg was also friendly with a Scot called Robert Pierce Gillies, who translated German literature into English. And one of the works he translated at about the same time that Confessions of a Justified Sinner was written was called The Devil's Elixir, which has a number of features in common with the Confessions. The devil appears. Is the protagonist mad? Is he being haunted? There are quite a lot of similar grounds. Hogg was very much part of the Romantic movement, picking up on what was going on in Germany at the time, in a way that seems surprisingly advanced for a man of little formal education.
And he's also writing a book with an untrustworthy narrator, something that we think of as a 20th century device, but seems rather ahead of its time.
Yes, it does. I mean, one of the fascinating things to do when you've read that book, the first time I read it, I immediately started again because having read the second narrative, in which there's an overlap of events with the first narrative, I wanted to go back and try and see if I could make all these little pieces of information cohere. And the answer is you can never quite do it.
Mm-hmm.
You start, it's interesting, I think it's a progression, because the editor, to begin with, seems like the rational Enlightenment, Sir Walter Scott, reliable editor kind of narrator. It's quite common with Gothic fiction to have a first-person unreliable account and then to have an editor step in and put all the pieces together. This editor seems to do that to begin with, but really he doesn't. And then gradually he becomes untrustworthy. He describes, for example, the rape of Robert Ringham's mother on her wedding night by her husband as a comic scene. And he talks sneeringly about women like a lower-class prostitute. And then suddenly you get her account of the event, and you see her as somebody who's shivering, who's got no money, who's being treated brutally by these sort of young gentleman type that the editor just approves of. So you come to question the editor very early on.
How was this reacted to at the time? What did people think? Did they see this as a work of genius?
No. They thought Hogg... The trouble is with being a peasant writer is that all the literary educated men think that they know better than you do about how writing should be done. So there were lots of jokes about the fact that the narrative, the main narrative, the sinner's confession, is found on a body that's exhumed from the ground in Hogg's native district. The Noctes Ambrosianae magazine were joking about this when Hogg said, you know, what would his reputation be in 100 years' time? The Noctes character said, oh, you'll be dug up quite fresh and lovely like this new hero of yours. A number of the early reviewers criticised the double narrative and said, you know, this man, James Hogg, he doesn't know how to write. He can't make up his mind whether the devil really exists or whether we're just dealing with a lunatic. Whereas today, that's the main feature that we admire about the novel, that it does hover between two interpretations, never coming down firmly on either of them.
Why do you think it took over 100 years for it to be appreciated?
I think it's a change in sensibility that we have. I mean, some people have always liked it. Robert Louis Stevenson read it and was so impressed by it that he thought it couldn't have been written by this uncouth shepherd from Ettrick, and that somebody like John Gibson Lockhart must have helped him with it. So it's always had its admirers. But I think there's been a shift in sensibility. I think the Victorians wanted things to be more in one mood, in one genre. Hogg, in a number of his writings, changes mood, changes genre, so that one minute you're reading something tragic, the next minute it's sort of slapstick comedy. There's always that uncertainty with him. Where do you place the narrator? Where does he stand?
And weren't a few of the editions of his works cleaned up with indelicate bits removed?
Very much so. Not only, I mean, not the Victorians didn't like his plain speaking about sexual matters. There's a story in one of his collections called The Shepherd's Calendar, which is about an attempted rape. And they try and tell that, but miss out all the sort of sex, which is quite strange. But with the Private Memoirs and Confessions of a Justified Sinner, what they objected to was the onslaught on extreme Calvinism. So it was cleaned up. The theological niceties were stripped out of the book, and it was published as Memoirs of a Fanatic. So that they tried to remove that ambiguity. They tried to remove the discomfort of reading an exaggerated and false version of Calvinist doctrine. I don't think Hogg was actually criticizing Calvinism. He was an elder of the Kirk of Scotland. He had family worship in his own family. He was a devout churchgoer. But what he was exploring was a dangerous tendency of something that he himself firmly believed in.
This book is greatly admired in Scotland today by every Scottish writer I have spoken to. Obviously, you recommend it. Is there something you could tell people who are wondering whether they should buy the book or not that might push them over the edge?
I certainly feel you should read it as a book for the time. James Robertson, his new novel, The Testament of Gideon Mack, is in effect a rewriting of The Confessions of a Justified Sinner. I think it tells you something about the split mind of the modern world. And I particularly feel it's no accident. André Gide's edition came out in 1947 after World War II, when people were so horrified by the opening of the death camps and what one person could do to another in the name of a limited and false ideology. I think today, with fundamentalism of every description, Christian and Islam, we do see again the relevance of the dangers of fanaticism.
I've been talking with Dr. Gillian Hughes of the James Hogg Society about James Hogg's 1824 novel, The Private Memoirs and Confessions of a Justified Sinner, the book we are recommending today as part of our Summer Underappreciated Reading series. Thank you so much. Thanks for listening to the Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other podcasts at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.